Okay, thank you. So today I'm going to talk about the development of three-dimensional virtual models to enhance conceptualization of soil morphology. And I want to acknowledge my co-author, Stephen Hasiotis, who is an ecologist at the University of Kansas. So at the University of Kansas, I teach an introductory soil morphology course, and I also teach an advanced soil geomorph course, and my colleague, Steve Hasiotis, teaches a paleopedology course. And so when we talk about morphology, one of the things that I'm going to focus on in this talk is simply the arrangement of soil particles and pores. There are many things that can go under the topic of soil morphology, but I'm going to focus on soil structure and pore structure. And one of the things we want to convey is the importance of soil structure as it affects so many different aspects of the environment and of soils. So there's a biological component that it affects, seedling germination, for example, and this is by no means exhaustive, root extension, plant anchorage, faunal locomotion even, and then some of the physical aspects are heat and water flux, aeration, nutrient availability and transport, infiltration and consequently land surface stability, mineral weathering by affecting soil water residence time in the soil, and soil genesis. So these are just some of the concepts that we want to convey in our courses. So just by way of a very quick review, we describe traditionally aggregate structure by assigning three classes to the structure: a type, which is essentially the shape, the size of the structure, and the strength of expression of that structure, which we call the grade. And so this is just a page out of the red field book put out by the NRCS on describing soil structure. So something like this photograph of a surface structure might be characterized as strong, coarse, granular structure. So the pore morphology is described by four classes. The kind, which again is the shape, and that tells you quite a bit about what made that pore. The size of the pore, the location of the pore, and the quantity or abundance of the pore. And so, again, here's another page out of that same field book that describes different kinds of pores. So something like this might be described as many medium vesicular pores throughout. Now, there's been a lot of discussion lately about MLT technology. It's a very promising technology. And one of the things that we want to explore in this presentation is, while we can go to the field and take actual PED structures and show students field excavations and structures, pore morphologies, and so on, it's quite difficult to apply that to online or distance education courses. And so what we want to do is explore this new technology in sort of bringing the field to the students. This is a desktop three-dimensional scanner. It's a multi-stripe laser triangulation. Is a structured light technique, so it greatly reduces the cost of these kinds of scanning images. It's very high resolution, about 120 micrometers. It's field portable because it's so small. And most importantly, it quantifies the pit scale, what I'm calling the macro scale here. So we can really take this information and bring it to students online. So this is an image of the scanner. You can see it's scanning a prism at the moment. It's there's a auto sampler in front of it that rotates the object and allows the topography to be scanned and captured and then quantified and displayed. So in teaching morphology, the challenge is conceptualization of these irregular 3D structures. The problem is that these structures are irregular and they extend in space. And so PEDs and pores are perfect examples of that. And so we propose this conceptual rubric for understanding what technologies will work best in different environments. So on the top row, we have three different viewing environments: a two-dimensional viewing environment, something like a sheet of paper or a computer monitor, true 3D environment, which is a stereoscopic environment, it's an apparent 3D environment, and then of course the actual three-dimensional environment, which would be physical models. And then in each of those three environments, we have three levels of user control. There's the case where the users have no control the case where the instructor controls the object, and the last case where the student is actually in charge of controlling the object. And so a two-dimensional non-interactive environment, which is displayed here in red, would be things like sketches, block diagrams, photos. These are things which have relatively limited utility in conveying the concept of soil morphology to students. This is why we take the students to the field. And the instructor-controlled interactive environments, 2D environments, are better. They allow the instructor to manipulate computer-projected virtual models, things like solid render, tins or meshes or point clouds, in front of the student's eyes, which help conceptualize soil morphology. And then the last, which we display here in green, conveys that this is what we think is the best way of doing this, is letting the students take charge of the virtual image, allowing them to rotate the object in any way they like to actually understand the concept. Now, the true 3D environments, which I won't spend a lot of time in, again, the same thing we see there in this sort of conceptual model is that the student-controlled interactive environment is the best, and the same thing for the physical models. Now, a non-interactive physical model would be something like a monolith that's hung on a wall. The student isn't going to take it off and move it around at will. It's quite heavy, it's fragile, and so on. And a student, however, might interact with PEDs that are brought to the lab, for example. Now, the problem with physical models are that this is dependent on your collection, your specimen collection. And so at the University of Kansas, for example, we have a fairly limited specimen collection. And so we want to try to beef that up, but that happens slowly. It's very costly. And so so we think that maybe the 2D student-controlled interactive environment is probably the best, and that's what we're going to focus on here. The last thing I'll say is the true 3D environment pretty helpful in conveying some of this information. However, there's a big cost in the hardware to display these images. These are stereoscopic displays or geo walls that have to be used to convey these images. So at the University of Kansas, we take the students to the field and at the beginning of the course, and they sample, they describe a profile, they sample it, and then they use that soil and they run that soil in the laboratory portion of the course the rest of the semester. So PEDs are examined, removed from the soil, and the structural classes are assigned. Clods are sampled from the profile, and then we determine the clod volumes using a paraffin-coated clod method. Now, we can do the same thing with a scanner. The MLT scanner can be applied to large or small aggregates. There's essentially no upper limit for the size of the aggregates. And you get a resulting digital elevation model that looks like this, that's completely enclosed and can be rotated and manipulated in a 2D environment. The volume and the surface area can be determined digitally through the software, and the diameter can be calculated. So these are all things that can be assigned to the students to do in order to calculate bulk density, get the volume of the PEDs, assign grade and size to the PEDs. Now, one thing we're also doing at the University of Kansas is we are collecting two monoliths every summer, and to beef up our collection. The pits are excavated, monoliths are carved and removed, and the monoliths are cleaned and impregnated. Needless to say, this is a very costly and time-consuming environment, especially for an assistant professor to be doing. But I think it's necessary for the students to see and actually work with the physical model. So what we thought is, since we're doing this anyway, why don't we take the scanner and make it field portable and go out to the pit and actually scan the wall of the pit and use that as a virtual monolith. So this is a pit, a hand-dug pit, I'll just add, that is being, the scanner is sitting in the pit, and an undergraduate student is there working with the scanner as this is one of our first scans. And we bring a pretty wicked generator out to the field and hook it up to a surge protector so we don't blow out our laptop or the scanner and scan away. This is a graduate student who's holding the laptop, and you can see the scanner below by his knee, and it's the pit is tarped, actually, and taking a photograph of the site and about to scan. What we quickly found out was that sunlight is a problem with the scanner. The scanner has a camera that observes the structured light as it moves across the face, and sunlight will block that signal from picking it up. So we started scanning at night to eliminate the problem of sunlight, and it takes about an hour to scan a meter and a half soil pit. And so this is scanning at night. You can see the laptop there in the blue glow. These are the laser stripes that are being shown from the scanner against the face of the excavation wall. And what it's doing is it's looking at the deformation of the lines and the distance between the lines to work out the topography of the surface. So this is a little video of the scanner working. It turns on its upper and lower lights to take a photograph of the object. This is when we were still tarping. Turns off the lights, so it's going to overlay a photograph on the point cloud data, and then it's about to turn on its lasers. There we go. So it has those four stripes of lasers that slowly move across the surface of the excavation wall, and it's a cleaned excavation wall, trying to make it look as natural as possible, just like you would when you describe it in the field. And it works out its topography from that. So the result are these digital profiles that we get. This is several profiles. The one on the right is a brownfield soil that has been, this is actually a soil monolith that was scanned in. And it shows the, you can see the change in gray. There's a sandy, about a 50 centimeter sandy mantle sitting on top of a structured argillic horizon there, which you can see, which is right about there. So the students can be asked to look at the structural grade, the size, and the type. Here, this comes with the photographs overlaid on the point cloud data, but here I've removed the photographs to sort of emphasize the structure of the profiles. They can be used to calculate horizon depths, and especially look at the macro pore morphology. When we first did this, there were a lot of defects in the mesh, a lot of holes coming back from the scanner. And initially, we thought, "Oh, shucks, that's a, you know, kind of a an unfortunate thing about the scanner." And the more we looked at it, the more we realized that the pores are actually outlining the PED structures. And so this is one of the reasons why the lasers don't return, is because it gets stuck in between the PEDs. Essentially, it shows up as a hole in the digital mesh, and so that can be used to help students understand macropore morphology and the concepts associated. This can also be used for advanced GIS assignments. Here's a section of the DEM with a bounding box around it, and these are some of the projected pores, the holes in the digital mesh that can be projected on 2D plane, and then they can be quantified with ImageJ or a variety of other software. We can, in addition to going to the field, we can also scan collected monoliths. This is a little stand that we created to hold the scanner to face down and move the monolith underneath the scanner. We can take casts of burrow traces. This is a sphinx burrow that's been casted by my colleague. We scanned it in, and we have a paper out in the journal Sedimentary Research that talks about different metrics we can use with this technology now. We can calculate length, angles, tortuosity, surface area, volume, surface roughness, and things like area and volume exploited. So surface area in particular has been unable to be quantified on PEDs or pore structures like this. So this is a really kind of a neat technology to do that with and convey those concepts. We're particularly excited about axisymmetrical pores. This is a core that was taken through the side of the excavation wall that shows a cicada nymph burrow with the cicada nymph inside the burrow. And we were able to scan that burrow in, not the nymph, and show the pore there and calculate its volume and put it over the total volume of the cylinder. So in summary, the application online courses, we haven't actually done this on online courses yet, but this is our hope and our goal, is that different formats can be used to display this data. And there's a number of file formats I've listed here, but the one I want to focus on is the SKP file, the Google SketchUp file, which Google SketchUp is a free online program, and it's got an enormous number of tools to measure lengths and angles and tortuosities, and it's platform independent, so we can save the files in this format. Various measurements can be made, including size, length, volume, surface area, etc. And what we really want to call for is a virtual library that we think is needed to quantify and to collect and preserve monoliths, pore structures, and PEDs and unique soil features. There's a number of institutions that have large and extensive and quite old collections of soil monoliths and PEDs and so on. And so we'd like to preserve those and disseminate them to the public and to other courses in the country and around the world using this technology. So, any questions?
Well, okay, any quick questions for Dan?
Yes. The scanner is $3,000, and it costs another thousand for the software, and about another thousand for the computing power. So, in total, about $5,000 for everything you need to start scanning. It's well within the range of small grant, small education grant kind of opportunities. So, yeah. The monolith is actually got the advantage, and the reason why is because the time that's put into preparation of the monolith is so much larger than the time it to measure or to clean off the face in an excavation wall. Partly because when you're working with a monolith, it needs to be sort of you can kind of control the moisture content. You can add a little bit more water here and let it dry a little bit longer and clean the face. With the pit face, you're sort of stuck with whatever the field conditions are. So on the flip side, you're actually scanning real conditions. And one of the things we notice with the monoliths is that as they dry, they start to shrink, and some of the structures get really well expressed, which is an advantage, but not necessarily representative of the field conditions. Yeah.
So now you talked about the moisture level. What was the ideal moisture level to do this without it affecting the pore space visualization?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question.
If you have water in the pores.
Water?
Yeah.
That's a great question. We don't know. The a lot of the pores that we're getting with the scanner are from when we first noticed that the pores were outlining the PED structures. It was where the PEDs were most strongly expressed, especially in the monolith scans. And so in that case, they're dry. There's no water in those cases. In the case of the field, we get these pores that we don't necessarily see in the field. And so a lot of those are shadings as the lasers move across the face. And so, but a lot of them are very, very small that we couldn't see anyway. So it's a great question. I'm not sure what the attenuation is when the laser interacts with water. Something we're sort of exploring.
Maybe one more question. I'll make sure there's time for other folks as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just curious about early discussions we had in collections of biological collections of insects or whatever that we're losing at a rapid rate in the world. Would this 3D methodology collect those images and store them?
Of the insects themselves,
yeah,
or? I think so. I think one of the things you're limited with is the size of the object. There's really no.
And the nature of the material.
Yeah, the nature. Less so on the nature, mostly on the size, and if the complexity is really great, it can do quite complex burrow networks, for example. But when it's difficult for the lasers to penetrate because you have constant shading, for example, something that we notice when we're scanning the very upper 5 to 10 centimeters of the profile, actually, where there's a lot of roots, there's a lot of holes that come back. The scanner is very sensitive to distance away from the surface that it's actually scanning. So it can be problematic. But your limit is really the thinness of the object, I think. The thinness of like legs or whatever on insects. But there's no real upper limit. On the soil, I'd say there's probably about the smallest soil PED you could scan is probably around 5 to 10 grams, something like that. So it's pretty small. So
okay. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Any other questions for any of the speakers here this afternoon? There are a few, some left anyhow. Yes.
students taking quizzes online. That's something I haven't struggled with it because I make the students come to the lab to take the quizzes. And their own time, they are waiting for you to come over. Because what I'm afraid of is, oh, right, the students are in a fraternity or something. And now you project the quizzes, the 10 of them come out there and argue it out and come up with the right answer. How do you deal with that?
We don't. Next question.
Yeah.
No, that's a problem. My face-to-face students, of course, take nothing online, but my asynchronous students, this is a new course for me. The first exam, they were in proctored rooms. They're remote, so they have some proctor, the paper exam. We're going to try an online exam with a proctored exam control room, because they're at 12 different junior colleges, and that's a different story. Now, of course, Mark has them show up face to face for his.
Right, if they don't, I mean, the quizzes don't count much, and so if they, there's no question, I've already feel there's probably files of them out there, but if they don't really learn them, if they don't use the quizzes to their advantage, then when they show up for the exam, they're going to be in trouble. So, and so they don't count much, and so they can't say one is A, because it randomizes the order of the questions and the order of the answers each time for each student. So that helps. At least they have to say, well, in this particular, they have to learn something about it, just even tell the person what the answer is.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good thing. I mean, if you have enough old quizzes out there with enough possible combinations, they're going to learn more trying to figure out the answers on the quizzes than they were going to the lecture. I mean, this is true in the 3060 course that Bill Miller teaches. There's so many old exams out there. For them to go through a bank of 30 exams and get the questions, they've learned the material by the time they're done.
Well, but the other side, I've been doing these intro courses for 10 years, and none of my exams are out there. I've carefully controlled the exams. The quizzes may be, but none of the exams are. And so there are no. I'm pretty positive there are no exams. So that's the other side, that when you come to the exams, you better have learned something because you have no previous one.
They'll figure out a way.
And they haven't figured it out yet.
You want to take a side bet on that, Mark?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I've really been good at it.
Each one memorizes one question.
Maybe anybody can answer this question. What is your final take on the online labs?
I don't think it's a perfect substitute for face-to-face labs because watching someone manipulate something by hand is different than telling them isolated, dig a hole and make big soil samples and things. It's a compromise. So I don't think you can really replace face-to-face, particularly with something like intro soils, which has a lot of techniques that you can learn by hand. So the equipment that's not available to you at home, and just someone looking over your shoulder, holding your hand basically while you're holding the soil texture.
It's interesting though, because I had a kind of the other view on that is that I had a number of students that, you know, they have to go up and do it themselves, and it's kind of interesting. One of the responses I've had is that the students, they feel that that was a better learning experience to have to do it themselves, to go out there and dig the pit, and do the work. Didn't rely have anyone to rely on, you know. So it kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah, because when you're doing a profile description in the field, I know, you know, my face-to-face students, most of them just stand back. It's hard to get them, almost push them and pull them around.
One will do it out of five or something, and then everybody else watches. This way, they're all required to do it themselves. I think that's a good feedback.
I'll support you and do a little shameless plug for my paper that came out back in December for American Journal of Distance Ed. And that was the result, as well as that the students that are have to do it. You know, the online student has to go out and actually dig a hole, whereas you have that group mentality in the classroom where guys are just kicking clods and not really paying any attention. And it shows up in the performance too, in the evaluations at the end. A lot of times the online students outperform
doing the work, and then my three lab mates were kind of reaping the benefits. But yeah, if it's an isolated, individualized experience, you have to learn because you're the only one doing it.
I have to ask this question though. Okay, so if you're digging one pit and you get the students out to dig one pit, the first thing that happens is they start digging in a compacted clay soil and they figure out I'm going to go to the loose, loamy, or sandy soil nearby. But I can see how if they have to dig one pit, that's fine. But how about in a course like pitology, when you want to see 15 or 20 pits? And I talked to Gary about this early. I mean, do you all not see the danger of, like, if I'm an administrator, I'm sitting there going, I got 500 students in Martin's course over here, and I'm generating $100,000. You know, should I support that course, or should I support a pedology course that I've got 20 students in and doesn't generate anything, because I use so much van gas money going back and forth to this? And I come at this with a very different problem. I think, you know, talk to me 2 years ago, I'd say, distance learning is tough. Don't do it, but I'm being beat into submission. But I still have this sort of concern, and I don't know, have any of you faced this, that sort of like these courses are doing so well that to some extent when you're thinking about replacing people, you know, are you replacing to the course rather than to the need of the profession? I don't know. I mean, maybe you haven't seen it. I worry.
I would certainly agree with the concern. I think that, I mean, we see this a lot of times. If you go back and look at a lot of universities, how many lab courses have been done away with? And they've been done away with because of costs. Field trips have been done away because of costs of field trips and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's something we have to be very, very careful about. I'm a strong believer in distance education. I think it can be very, very effective. But I think the idea of looking at distance education, which I've heard a lot here, of being a cash cow, is a problem. I think the cash cow part is the biggest problem, not the education.
Well, I really have a question addressed to Dr. Morris, but in line with that, at the University of Maryland, we've instituted lab fees so that they're charged, and we find that really is an impediment to having students.
Well, we've done that too in certain areas.
Yeah,
but there still is a lot of places that have given up lab courses.
Yeah. But also, back in the 70s, when I took pedology, we went out in teams of four on our own. And then the instructor would come visit each one of our, we all had 40 acres to do, and it was really not, I mean, I'm not a soil scientist, but it's something that I would never forget.
Right.
And
That's a
great
effective way to teach.
Yeah, I would have forgotten it if it was online. But that wasn't why I raised my hand.
Okay.
I am in awe of your class, all the obstacles that you got everybody, the administrators from all those institutions to agree on this. That's amazing.
But the thing about it is, we took the path of least resistance. The obvious path would have been
wonderful.
To have a course that everybody agrees it's taught this way at the same number with the same test. We don't do that. We have a course taught, but the kind of the administrative things, what level it is, how many credit hours, there are actually some variation of credit hours, how the exams, I would say that we took the path of least resistance, and if any administrators got together, thank you for the compliment, but they would say, what do you mean you're doing this?
Yeah.
So that's what is sort of the downside. And we just had an evaluation of our program, and that was one of the comments that came up. You teach this combined course, but the students are actually doing slightly different things.
But they're obviously engaged. But one thing I did want to bring up is since I teach ecosystem services as well, and your unit that you have coming up on spiritual and cultural services, at the University of Maryland, we just dedicated the Garden of Remembrance and Reflection. And I just finished my unit where the spirituality was non-denominational. It was all about peace, pathways for peace, and it really worked into it because we have a new president who dedicated the garden. He even talked about ecosystem services and how important that is. So I would ask you to think about something that would not be religious but spiritual.
The difficulty, then you're ignoring things like, you know, the sacred soil do that, and I do that kind of as a, and I'm not a theologian, but we do that sort of to provide this sort of difference in backdrop.
Yeah. Well, in your outline, you presented as Jewish.
I did.
Yeah, whatever.
But there's much more detail as we go through.
Yeah.
That's sort of like a catch. But we talk about Islam. We talk about the Bodai tree. I'm trying to think of some of the other
things.
Yeah,
I mean, that's great.
The Garden of Shinsu.
Yeah.
I mean, we
yeah.
talk about all that as part of the lecture. So it does have 7 or 8 major religions brought in, plus the
there
native,
the
indigenous
yeah.
peoples or the first peoples. I would say that I probably do a poor job of it, but the students love it.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
unit got so much message board activity last year that it was almost overwhelmed the rest of the course. So they get to pick out like songs from popular culture and say what their favorite music is. And so I start with 3 or 4 things, and I use like, you know, Jethro Tull's Song from the Wood and stuff like that, and they bring it in. So it actually works as a distance learning. Probably the message board works better there than the actual lectures.
Well, I'm glad I asked because it sounds like it's